Your Holiness, with your permission, I think we would like to move on to the third presentation. Then we'll save all of our time at the end for the discussion and questions. Is that okay with you?
Yes.
Dr. McKeown.
Can you all hear me? Not yet. Okay. Is that better? All right. Your Holiness, your belief in science and what it has to offer has been an inspiration to me and to all of us. And I'm very much honored and pleased that we could host this event here at the Rockefeller University. What I have to tell you is going more deeply into the brain and the phenomenon that we call stress. And I have two points to make. One is to talk a little more about the good as well as the bad side of stress, and more, even more importantly, to talk about the plasticity and resilience of the brain and some of the circuits in the brain that you've already heard about from Richie Davidson. So you're going to see this slide again many times, but what we should look at first is the middle, the brain, which is the central organ of stress and adaptation. It is where memories are stored, where the lived experience is stored, where it then has effects on our behavior and also on the rest of the body, downwards through the physiologic responses of systems like the ability to produce cortisol. And from left to right at the bottom, this notion, which is called allostasis, emphasizes the idea that these responses, like our cortisol response, being able to turn it on and then turn it off again, is part of what leads us to adapt to stressors, to new situations. And at the very bottom in yellow is this concept that we call allostatic load, which is really just a way of saying that those same mediators like cortisol, when they are overused, when there's too much of them, or when they are dysregulated with respect to other mediators, they contribute to disease. And so the goal is to maximize adaptation and minimize those negative effects of stress, of the response to stress. Now, if we look at the secretion of cortisol, the brain, of course, controls that secretion through the pituitary gland. Cortisol comes from the adrenal gland. And on the right, in the red, emphasizing the fact that when cortisol is released in response to an acute stress, it actually enhances the ability of the immune system to defend our bodies. It improves certain aspects of memory, like to avoid something that might be dangerous. It promotes replenishment of energy supplies and more efficient cardiovascular function. But when cortisol is overproduced, or when we give cortisol, perhaps intentionally, it can suppress immune function, suppress inflammation. It also can impair memory. And when it's produced chronically, it can promote bone mineral loss and even wasting of muscles, and contributes to what we call the metabolic syndrome, which is related to diabetes and other conditions, which are very unfortunately all too prevalent in modern life. Now, what you see here is the DNA double helix, and this notion of epigenetics refers to this important idea that we've had for a long time, that the environment controls the expression of our genetic code, and without changing the code itself. But there are various ways in which the genes that we have are their ability to be expressed are altered by chemical changes in parts of the DNA itself, but also in proteins which are able to bind to the DNA and either make it unfold and express its information or actually become repressed. And actually, here at the Rockefeller University, I was lucky enough to be a student in the laboratory of pioneers in this area, Vincent Alfrey and Alfred Mirsky, and currently David Allis is one of our professors who is a world's expert in this area of epigenetics. And cortisol also affects this process. So here we see this slide again, in which it highlights the different kinds of stressors. We have, of course, trauma and abuse, major life events like death, birth, divorce, loss of job, and we have the daily hassles of our working and living and neighborhood and national and international environment. Now to go a little bit further, since stress is an ambiguous term, and some people think of it in a more positive way, there is something we can call positive stress, where, like we're doing now, giving a talk, hopefully having a good reception of the talk, feeling exhilarated from a successful outcome. In order to do that, we have to basically have good self-esteem, a good sense of mastery and control, having experience, and having internally good brain architecture that enables us to do this. Then there's tolerable stress. And tolerable stress is when something bad happens, adverse life events. But we have that good brain architecture. We have the external and internal resources. We have support from family and friends. We have adequate financial resources. And we can weather the storm. And we have resilience and we can recover. And then there's something called toxic stress, which almost speaks for itself. And toxic stress may be related to having a somewhat insufficient brain architecture that doesn't enable us to have these positive features. It may also be a reflection of early life abuse and neglect that we've heard about, and poor or very limited support from friends, family, and of course financial limitations. And that brings us to the adverse childhood experiences studies that were done by our Centers for Disease Control, but they were done in the Kaiser Permanente Health System in California, which is a middle class population. So what we're talking about is not just the plight of poor people, but the plight of our middle class. And I think it's, of course, increasing concern worldwide that we're all under a lot of stress. And on the left, besides what we've already mentioned, such as verbal abuse and financial worries, living in a single parent family, having an alcoholic family member, having one member of the family incarcerated in prison, depression in the family, neglect by the caregivers, and of course physical and sexual abuse, the more of this there is, and there is an ACE score, the higher is the incidence later in life of heart disease, of the propensity to smoke, of obesity, of drug abuse, higher risk for acquiring AIDS, major depression, anxiety, anger control, and antisocial behavior. So this is a major, major contributor to the diseases of modern life. Now, talking about, it's not just the stressful experiences, but also our lifestyle, behaviors we engage in on a daily basis in order to accommodate. The term stressed out really means that, because we often feel overwhelmed, out of control, exhausted, anxious, frustrated, angry. And what happens? We may lose sleep at night. We've heard also mentioned, I think Liz Nielsen mentioned today, about the sleep deprivation of having a harsh boss, or shorter sleep, eating too many of the wrong things, drinking alcohol in excess, smoking.
Yes.
and also neglecting the regular physical activity that we know is important to us. So all of these contribute to this wear and tear on the body that I called allostatic load, the price that the body pays for these conditions. So it's not just the experiences, but it's how we deal with them in terms of our behavior. And then we come to the brain. And we talk about brain regions. But before that, we talk about the fact that we have nerve cells on the left that have dendrites that are receiving information from other nerve cells. It turns out that these dendrites can grow or shrink. They can become more complex, develop more connections, or shrink and develop fewer connections. In the middle, this is where the synaptic connections are, the information through this chemical neurotransmission. These synapses turn over. They are formed and replaced during our adult life and as a result of experience of various kinds, stressful and not. And then on the right, there's a limited amount of neurogenesis that occurs throughout adult life in areas of the brain, particularly in this area you've already heard about called the hippocampus. So the ability to generate new nerve cells in adult life is very important. It turns out it's enhanced by exercise. It can be suppressed by lack of exercise or also by certain stressors. So we may have more or fewer nerve cells in this particular brain area because of this. You're going to see this again in various forms, but I'm going to talk briefly about three areas of the brain: the hippocampus, which is important for memory and also for mood regulation. It's important for shutting off the stress response that we've heard about, and it undergoes the shrinkage and loss of nerve cells, loss of neurogenesis under chronic stress. The amygdala is the brain area that's involved in anxiety, fear, and aggression. It also turns on the production of stress hormones, increases heart rate, increases that stress response. And one part of the amygdala, actually under the same kind of chronic stress that causes the hippocampal nerve cells to shrink, these nerve cells expand and become more connected, and fear and anxiety increase as a result. And then we have the prefrontal cortex, which we've already heard about in the context of self-regulatory behaviors. That's the important brain region for that. It's involved in self-regulatory behaviors, also in decision-making, working memory, various kinds of impulse control. And it also shuts off the stress response, works with the hippocampus. And it tends to show a shrinkage of dendrites and loss of synapses with chronic stress. It's also one of the last brain areas to fully develop as a child grows older. And it's that growth and formation of these connections which is very important for the development of these self-regulatory behaviors that we've heard about. So what we have then with stress, the good and the bad side, acutely stress can help us remember better. It can, but more severe acute stress can actually have inhibitory effects, so we have this U-shaped curve. We also have adaptive plasticity, which I talked about, this shrinkage, which, by the way, is largely reversible in a healthy brain if you stop the stress. In a brain that has a depressive or anxiety disorder, the ability to come back, to rebound, the resilience may be limited or even lacking. And then finally, the bad side is when we have a seizure, a stroke, or a head trauma, then there's permanent, irreversible loss of nerve cells. And ironically, the cortisol, the glucocorticoid, and the transmitters that help the good side are actually involved in causing this permanent, irreversible damage. So it's, again, how do we promote the good side and minimize the bad side? So the hippocampus under stress shows shrinkage in major depression, in type 2 diabetes, which is, of course, a worldwide problem, post-traumatic stress disorder, and also in Cushing's disease, where the body is producing too much cortisol. The good news is that, at least in Cushing's disease, and perhaps also in depression, if we treat it, there may be at least partial reversal of some of this shrinkage and improvement of mood and improvement of memory. But in our modern lives, without disease, we know that a long-time history of chronic stress may lead to a smaller hippocampus and impaired function, that chronic jet lag, traveling without having adequate time between trips, will lead to shrinkage of the hippocampus and memory impairment, that lack of exercise is associated with smaller hippocampus, and that chronic inflammation, which is part of all the diseases of modern life, is associated with a smaller hippocampus. But let's then talk about the good side and what we can do about it. And so we'll talk very briefly about regular physical activity, social support and integration, and cognitive behavioral therapies, especially mindfulness-based stress reduction. In the case of the hippocampus, we know that regular exercise, I'll give you an example in a moment, intense learning, and also antidepressant treatments, including exercise, will actually benefit the hippocampus and in some cases will actually enlarge it. Now, this is a recent study by a group at the University of Illinois. Elderly subjects who were sedentary walked an hour a day, 5 out of 7 days a week. And over the space of a year, on the top, both their left and their right hippocampus got larger, presumably in part because there were new neurons produced, but also perhaps because of other changes in the dendrites and other kind of things. But a real significant increase and improvement of the behaviors that are dependent on the hippocampus. The amygdala, which you've heard about, which we know becomes overactive in anxiety disorders and depression. There is a study using a mindfulness-based stress reduction from the Harvard Mind-Body Center that actually shows on the right-hand side, there's a perceived stress scale that measures your sense of being stressed out. And what it shows is that people who show reductions in their anxiety and their perceived stress actually show larger volumes of the amygdala, which is something we might predict on the basis of some studies on animal models. But this also illustrates the important point. We have to use subjects as their own controls and measure changes in the brain in relation to changes in their behavior. And finally, the prefrontal cortex, which really is probably one of the most important structures we've been talking about in terms of these self-regulatory behaviors. On the right is a list of many of the negative things that are involved, impaired function from chronic perceived stress or jet lag, impaired development from early life adversity, neglect, or chaos in the home setting, resulting in poor self-regulatory behaviors that we've already talked about. One study, again using a mindfulness-based stress reduction scheme, took people who had chronic fatigue syndrome, which is a very mysterious but very debilitating disease, found that those people who benefited in terms of reduced symptoms showed enlargement of their prefrontal cortical gray matter volume, which again suggests you follow the same subjects and that behavior actually may change the brain. And finally, Liz Nielsen spoke this morning about the Experience Corps, this very important program of having volunteers, a study actually involving some of the same people who did the exercise study and who've also shown improvements in prefrontal cortical function with regular exercise, found that the activity of being a volunteer in the Experience Corps, which involves increased physical activity, but also making friends and feeling meaning and purpose in life, actually improved prefrontal cortical function. So really the message then in this final slide, which I showed you earlier, is the question of can we harness this intrinsic plasticity and resilience of the brain, and how does it fit into what we're discussing today? How would we take advantage of it in relation to the things that we all feel are important? Thank you very much.